There was a man who had two sons. The younger said to his father,
Father, I want right now what's coming to me.
So he divided his property between them.
A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and took a trip to a distant land.
And where he wasted all his money in wild living. He had spent everything. When a bad famine spread through that whole land, soon he had nothing to
eat. He was hungry and needed money. So he went and got a job with one of the people who lived there. The man sent him to the fields to feed pigs.
He would have been glad to eat what the pigs were eating, but no one gave him a thing. Finally,
he came to his senses, he said, how many of my father's hired servants have food to spare?
And here I am starving to death. I'm going back to my father. I'll say to him, Father, I've sinned against God. I've sinned before you.
I am no longer worthy to be called your son.
But let me be like one of your hired workers. So he left and he went to his father. While the son was still a long way off,
he
felt sorry for him.
His father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son.
So he ran to him and
hugged him around him and kissed him.
The son said, Father, I have sinned against God and have done wrong to you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son.
I don't deserve to be called your son ever again.
But the father said to his
servants. But the father wasn't listening. He was calling to the servants, quick, bring a clean set of clothes and dress him. Put the family ring on his finger and sandals on his feet.
Get the best calf and prepare it.
Bring the fat calf
and celebrate.
Let's have a feast and celebrate.
This son of mine was dead, but has now gone back to life.
Son of mine was dead and has returned to life. He was lost and is found.
He was lost.
So the party
and is
began.
Found.
Up for lost
so
and
they
now
began
found.
To celebrate.
And they began to have a wonderful time.
The question I have to ask myself when I look at that story, I think, okay, Jesus talked in parables so that whoever was listening could find themselves in the story, so that I could see me in the story and apply it to my life. When I look at that story and I think of myself as the prodigal, I wonder, how did the son get to that point? How did it get to that stage? I'm guessing he didn't just wake up one day and decide, you know what, I'm going to be the prodigal son and people will remember me forever for the rest of time that way. I'm guessing that it was a pretty slow drift. Slowly but surely, he drifted away from who he was. I remember this one time when I was a kid. We had some family friends that had a lake cabin. Full disclosure, I grew up in Montana. Don't judge me. And our friends had this lake cabin at this mountain lake. It was out in the middle of nowhere. Go figure, because what in Montana isn't in the middle of nowhere? And we would go there often, and honestly, some of my best childhood memories were at this lake, Lake Inez. Anybody ever been there? Okay, you're in my family, so. And one summer, his dad, my good friend, his dad had taken the week off work because he needed to go do some work at the lake cabin, so he brought us along. And one morning we got up and we were out in the boat. You know, kneeboarding was kind of a thing back then. Since I'm 40, you know now that that was like late 80s. We did that a little bit. We rode around on the inner tube, you know, lake stuff, and it was fun. But finally his dad said, okay, I got to get some work done or this whole trip is a waste for me. So he went to work on the cabin, and we got this ginormous inner tube. Have you seen those ones like 4 or 5 people can fit on them? You tow them behind your boat. We got that out. Put it in the water, and we jumped on it, and we just started floating out there. You know, other boats would go by, and the wake would push us up and down, and we'd play King of the Hill when that would happen and try to push each other off. And we were out there for a couple hours doing this, and I look back to the shore where the cabin was, and I realized someone had moved our cabin. Either that or your dad's just incredible. He tore down the old cabin and built an entirely new cabin without us noticing. Someone had moved our cabin. And then I realized, no, I see it. It's about this big and about a half a mile away down there, down the shore. While we were playing, while we were having fun, of course, what I know now is that like every other lake in the world, or almost every other lake in the world, there's an inlet and an outlet, and the water moves from one to the other. And so did we. We slowly were drifting along. And now that I'm 40 years old and I'm kind of reflective because, you know, I'm like just starting the third quarter right now, halftime's over, I realize in many ways that's how I go through life. There's some things that I'm really intentional about, but there's other ways that I'm just sort of drifting. You ever had one of those moments where you wake up and 10 years has gone by and you're like, oh, how'd I end up here? I saw this meme because I was, you know, reflective and 40. I was looking for 40-year-old memes, and I saw this one. It was a guy who was like, had his hand up and he was celebrating in one, and it said, I'm turning 40 today. And then there was another picture of the same guy with a sad face. It said, I'm turning 40 today and I'm 50. Because sometimes we just drift and time goes by and you think, how did I end up here in this spot? A lot of times that's how we move through life. We get busy. Maybe you're pursuing an education because someday you're going to do this for a job. Or maybe you're raising the kids, you know, and if you have little kids, you're like just happy to survive the day, right? You mentally and emotionally, them physically. You're just glad for that. Maybe you're building a career. Maybe you have career ambitions. And before you know it, you turn around and 10 years has gone by and you think, how did I end up here? I just drifted. This is how we often go through life. While we're busy building a life, we're drifting wherever it's taken. As it pertains to faith, it's a really interesting thing. Charles Darwin, who was the father of evolution, he didn't actually create it, but he certainly expanded on it and made the theory, popularized it. He described in his autobiography the process by which he lost his faith, and he said that it happened so slowly that he lost his faith in God that by the time he realized it was happening, he wasn't even worried about it because the work was complete. He had already arrived there. In fact, he wrote in a letter to his wife, Emma, about this process, and he described it as a slow and fragile process like the raising of continents. It's a very Darwinian thing to say. But he described this really slow process by which we slowly drift away from God. It's a normal thing that we all experience. Gallup, they're a research group. You probably heard all about, you know, heard their name all over the place during the elections. They do all kinds of statistical analysis, and they found in their most recent study that about 9 out of 10 Americans believe in the existence of God. Isn't that interesting? I mean, that's a pretty overwhelming majority. Right about 90% believe in the existence of God, but a very small percentage of us actually express any feeling of closeness or connection to God. I bet a lot of us are like, yeah, I get that. I'm in that number. The statistic tells me that there's something inherent within us that understands the existence of God, but when it comes to finding our way to make a connection there, that's where we get lost. Figuring out that there is a God, that's the part that we can connect to, but having a relationship with God, drawing close to God, that's the part that we struggle with. So what do? Well, we get busy raising the kids, getting an education, chasing a career, dealing with whatever is right in front of us. That's the course of nature that we all experience. And what happens is, I'm going to make just a total confession, sometimes I even create distractions in my life just to slow down the wheels in my head, you know, just so I'm not thinking about the deeper things that have long-range consequences. Netflix binge, anyone been there? Yeah, totally. You totally get that. We do things like that just to push it to the side so we can think about it later. This is the drift we all experience. There was a guy named Isaiah in the Bible. He lived right about 700 years before Jesus, and he was a prophet. Now, when I say the word prophet, when I say that word, I have this image of generally a pretty strange person, right? Like, if someone comes to me and says they're a prophet, I'm going to think of them as, you know, okay, you and I are like at arm's length until I figure out for sure if I trust you. That's going to happen. Sorry if you're a prophet, but that's just what comes up. Well, in Isaiah's day, it was a little different. Because in our day, if someone claims to be a prophet, and then what they say doesn't happen, what do? We're just like, they're kind of wonky. I'll probably steer clear of them. It was a different story in Isaiah's day. If you claimed to be a prophet, and then what you said didn't happen, they would literally drag you out into the street and pummel you to death with rocks. So there was really strong incentive to actually be a prophet if you said you were a prophet. This is what Isaiah said in Isaiah 53:6. He said, we all, like sheep, have gone astray. Every one of us has turned to our own way. So if you're wondering to yourself, how come other people seem to have this like connection with God, and I kind of believe in God, but I don't have that connection. If you're wondering, you're normal. You're one of us. We all like sheep have a tendency to stray away from their flock, from the safety of their shepherd, Isaiah says, you know what? That's all of our natural disposition. We all do that. After Isaiah, about one generation later, there was another prophet named Jeremiah. Same situation. You have to tell the truth or they'll kill you. And God would speak to the people through Jeremiah, which is really risky because if, you know, you say, hey, God told me to tell you this, and then it doesn't happen, it's a bad deal. Jeremiah, he said this in Jeremiah 29:13. God told the people, you'll seek me and you'll find me when you do it with all your heart. That tells me if you want to know God, you can. That's what God is saying to the people. If you want to know me, you can. So fast forward, a little over 700 years from there, about 20 years after the life of Christ, there was a guy named James. James was actually the half-brother of Jesus. That had to be a strange household. I'm sure yours was strange. His was stranger. James wrote at the time a letter to all Christians everywhere. It's appropriately named James. And he said that if you draw near to God, he will draw near to you. Now, if anybody would know that Jesus was a fraud, certainly it would be James. Certainly James would have figured that out. Because, you know, I have a brother and, you know, he knows that, yeah, okay. James said, if you draw near to God, he will draw near to you. So I want to ask you to take a daring step today. A dare sounds really intense. I want to ask you to consider the likelihood that maybe God wants to be found even worse than you'd like to find him. Maybe that's true. Maybe God wants to be found, but I've been so busy like creating distractions for myself that I haven't actually been able to intentionally pursue him in that way. Take the challenge to pray the prayer that Pastor Rick just mentions. God, if you're real, make yourself real to me. I think that's fair to put the ball in God's court and say, God, if you're real, would you make yourself real to me? That's a fair thing to ask. God, if you're real, would you make yourself real to me? This morning, I got up at about 5 a.m., which I do on Sundays, and here's the reason. I'm kind of a morning person, but like I got to warm up to the idea of social interaction. You know what I mean? I don't know. I haven't decided if it's okay for a pastor to need to warm up to people, but I'm just being honest with you. Some of you are totally, you get that. You go to work, and everyone knows, okay, don't talk to them until like 9:30, 9:40. So that's what I do. And the truth is, like, I love Center Church. I love the people here. And so I want to be at my best. So I get up at 5 and I try to get some exercise, you know, get the blood flowing. And when you go to the gym at 5 o'clock on Sunday morning, if there's anyone there, they'll be crabbier than you. So you're already like a leg up on someone. So I went to the gym this morning. I got up at 5 a.m. Now, here's the thing. I would never wake up at 5 a.m. on my own. It wouldn't happen. Some of you are like, is 5 a.m. even real? I thought that was just like an uphill both ways thing that your parents said to scare you. It's real, and it's awful. Don't try it. It's real. I would never wake up at 5 a.m. on my own. It just wouldn't happen. There has to be an alarm. There has to be an awakening. There has to be something to wake me up at 5 a.m. And over the next 5 weeks, as Pastor Rick mentioned, at Center Church, we're going to explore this series of awakenings that God often uses to draw us back to him. And one of the awakenings he often uses that I'm sure you'll connect to is our sense of longing, our sense of understanding that there has to be something more. There has to be something significant about this life. It's a longing that we all have, and God often uses it to draw us back to him. So we got a little bit of an introverted group here, so we're going to try and exercise, okay? Extroverts, this is your moment to shine. Introverts, rise up. You can do it. The greatest band of my generation is U2. There's two kinds of people in the world. There's people who like U2, and there's people who just haven't found out yet. They just don't know what's going on yet. One of the most popular songs by U2, in fact, one of the most popular songs on their best-selling album, The Joshua Tree, greatest band in the history of rock music, greatest album, is a really famous song. It has a very famous hook line. So this is what we're going to do. I'm going to start it. And you finish, all right? You ready? With all your strength, just muster it up. You don't even have to say it loud, just say it. Are you ready? I'm about to sing in front of you, Riley. This is about to happen. All right. But I still haven't found. Look at, oh, wow, you were better singers than me. You even sang it instead of saying it. I'm so proud of you. Here's what happens. If you think about, like, the melody of the song, it's actually not that impressive. But what happens is we realize two things in this song. One is even Bono still hasn't found what he's looking for. I mean, surely if somebody was going to find it, it would be Bono, the guy with unlimited resources and fame. And the second thing is we all know what he's talking about. All of us normal people are like, yeah, I get it. I still haven't found what I'm looking for. Even Bono knows. He still haven't found what I'm looking for. So I want to do this really quick. I want to show you another video because I want you to hear from three people named Bryce and Melissa and Jake. And this is what I want you to do. When you hear their story, maybe just reflect on your own story. Some of the details, of course, will be different, but I bet you'll see some things in there that might be similar to your story. You know, as human beings, we all have a sense of longing, a need for significance, a need for meaning in our lives. It's a universal experience that we all can really connect to. And here's what happens. We see this in the video. Those longings sometimes will lead us toward the best, most enjoyable, most fulfilling, most life-giving experiences and relationships. But those longings, when they're misguided, sometimes will harvest a massive amount of regret and sorrow in our lives. Probably you understand that. Eventually, you'll probably live long enough to understand that if you haven't already. We see that in each one of these people's stories. Their longings took them sometimes to places they wanted to go, sometimes to places they really wish they hadn't gone. But I want you to consider the possibility that this parable of the lost son and these longings that we have, maybe these are God's mechanism for drawing you toward him. Maybe God's using your longing for something more to actually lead you to something more. What if that's true? What if that's a reality? The parable of the lost son, we see a man who has two sons in Luke 15. In Luke 15, 11, it says, there was a man who had two sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." We find this young man coming to his father. He's at this moment where he's being sucked in by the current of life. And he's saying to himself, "I still haven't found what I'm looking for. There has to be more than just staying here, taking care of dad's farm, waiting for someday." And so he comes to his father and he says essentially, "You know what? You're better off actually dead to me. Just give me my money so that I can go do what I want." In their ancient Near Eastern culture, this was unbelievably offensive because honor was all they had. There was no door to. You stay, you take care of your parents, you cultivate what they cultivated. That's all there was in this case. But then we see him say, "You know what? I want something else. This isn't satisfying. There's got to be more. This isn't giving me satisfaction." Maybe we don't respond the same way he does. We respond in different ways because we have a different context, but we do things like change addresses, change relationships, churches, cars, jobs, all manner of material things. We make changes in our lives, and sometimes there's good reason for it, but sometimes we're just pursuing what will be more fulfilling because what we currently have maybe isn't. As an example, our society, don't raise your hand if this is you, as a society, we tend to live at the maximum extent of our means, sometimes just a little higher. Like as a society, we do that. Not everyone, but the person who lives below their means, beneath their means, is kind of in the minority. That's why we're always looking towards someday. Someday I'll be more fulfilled. And what we see in the younger son is really three longings that we all experience. His longing for purpose, his longing for love, and his longing for meaning. Three longings that we all experience. We all desire purpose. When my kids were 4 or 5 years old, they would have conversations about what they wanted to do for their job. Like, vocationally, when I grow up, this is what I want to be. Now, maybe you put financial pressure on your preschoolers. Brandy and I didn't. Maybe we're slacker parents. But there's no way they could have been aware of, like, the adult realities of finance at 4 years old. So why would they even be thinking about what they wanted to do occupationally? And the reason is because even at that young age, they're aware of the fact that their life has a unique purpose, that their life has its own purpose to be fulfilled in the future, even at the youngest age. And this is what I know in my life. The need for purpose is one of the earliest developing and loudest voices in our lives. I can tell you, I could just go on forever about all of the decisions I've made because of my need for purpose. Like standing up here doing this is one of them, deciding to be a pastor. And I bet you've probably made some significant decisions because of the need for purpose. The second longing that we all experience and that we see in this the younger son is the longing for love, longing for acceptance. Verse 13 says, not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there he squandered his wealth on wild living. In translation, the phrase wild living, actually, you could translate it to mean shameless immorality. And we learn actually later in the story from the older son that he squandered his wealth on prostitutes. That's what he spent his money. Like, of all things, that's what he spent the bulk of his money on. A guy named G.K. Chesterton, sounds really distinguished, and it is. Go figure, he's a philosopher and poet. I know that's a surprise with a name like G.K. Chesterton. He's also English. He said that the man who rings the bell at the brothel does so unconsciously seeking God. And I think that's actually true. It looks different in our context. You know, in this case, it was he squandered his wealth on prostitutes. Totally different context, but think about like our society. We have definitely a casual hookup culture. We have a culture of office romance, Facebook flirting, you know, all those kinds of things that are more appropriate to our culture. But what are those things? All of those things are just an outcropping of our need for love, for acceptance, for someone to validate us and to want us in that way, someone to give us their approval. Well, a strange turn of events happens in this son's life. He goes out. He's pursuing his purpose. He spent his money in the pursuit of other people's approval. And then eventually he runs out of money. And he finds there's a famine in the land, which would be equivalent to like vast economic depression in our day. He finds himself doing something no kosher Jewish boy would ever do. He takes a job at a pig farm. Anybody ever been to a pig farm? Because, okay, a couple of you. You can validate this for me to those who haven't. He ends up in such a bad position that it says he actually wants to get down and eat the pig's food. If you've never been to a pig farm, I can assure you, you don't want to eat the pig's food. There are better options. But that's how desperate he is. That's where he gets to. And in his hour of desperation, he does what we do. He starts to ask himself the why questions. What's the meaning of this? How did I get in this position? Why is this happening to me? He starts to ask the same kind of questions that we ask when we're in moments of desperation. And when he comes to the end of trying to find purpose, trying to find this approval of others, he's still unfulfilled. He starts to ask, why am I such a mess? Why is this situation so screwed up? And when the frustration of life brings you to that point, we kind of come to a crossroads. We have a couple options. The first thing we can do is get really busy dealing with the things of life and creating distractions so that we don't have to think about it. You know, we just sort of punt the ball farther down the field. Or we can ask ourselves, is God actually trying to use this situation to lead me to him? Here's why I think it's the second one. If you've been a Christian for any length of time, I'm sure you've experienced this. God does his most effective work in your life during the hard times. That's a pretty universal truth. Bill Gates says success is a terrible teacher. Success is a really poor teacher. Because when we're succeeding and things are going smoothly, guess what? I don't feel the need for God. God does the most work in our lives during the hard times. We most often wake up to the things of God during the suffering and frustration. I hate that. I wish it wasn't true, but it's reality. Those are the moments that I realize my need for God. God uses those times to draw us to himself. And I don't know the details of your story, but what I do know is that the answer to those longings isn't just out there over the hill, you know, in the elusive beyond. We think just someday when I get to this point or that point, I'll be fulfilled. I do know that it's not out there. And I do know that Jesus is the answer for that. I don't want to assume that everyone just believes that because I'm saying it, so I want to give you a historical example. Jesus had 12 disciples. his 12 closest followers. One of them, named Judas, betrayed Jesus, and it was because of Judas that Jesus was arrested and ultimately killed. Now, consider this possibility, I guess it's a reality, is that after Jesus was crucified, Judas felt so guilty, history tells us that he actually took his own life because he felt so guilty. Does it seem reasonable that if Judas thought Jesus was a fraud, he would have felt that guilty? No. He obviously felt that guilty because he knew Jesus was the real thing and I had betrayed him. But set Judas aside. The other 11 disciples, they all walked closely with Jesus. And here's what's interesting about them. Yes, they're biblical figures, but they're also historical figures. We can read about them in other places besides the Bible. Josephus, Eusebius, Hegesippus, my favorite, Cornelius Tacitus, the Roman historian, not a Christian, not a Jew, just a guy who wrote down what happened. I know I just got so nerdy for like 7 seconds there. You're like, what just happened? All of those are people who just documented history. And you can find the stories of the disciples in their writings. Here's what's really interesting about these historical figures. Every single one of them found purpose, love, and meaning through Jesus. Here's how we know that. Of the remaining 11, 10 of them were martyred because of their faith in Christ. They decided it was better for them to die than to say, I don't believe Jesus is who he said he is. That's pretty strong conviction. Oh, by the way, the 11th one, John, who survived longer than the others, he actually died of natural causes, but in exile because of his faith in Jesus. So it's not like he just got off free. All of them discovered their purpose through Jesus. They all found a life's work. All of them discovered love, community, acceptance, friendship, companionship through Jesus. All of them found meaning through Jesus. An answer to the question, why am I here? In fact, they felt so strongly about it that they were willing to die for it. Consider them as just a practical example of the fact that Jesus might just be the answer to your longings as well. So I want to just take the last couple of minutes that we have together, and I just want to tell you a story, because I have been in your seat, and I know that it's the stories that I remember. And it's really a problem in here that every person in this room is facing a clock except the person with the microphone. I just want to tell you this story, and some of you will remember this story. It was all over the national news. It's been a few years ago, but on June 5th, 2002, a girl named Elizabeth Smart was kidnapped out of her home in Salt Lake City. A lot of you guys probably remember that. And she was kidnapped by a couple who ended up keeping her captive for quite a long time, actually. And you might remember, the thing that I most vividly remember is the day her father, Ed Smart, came out of his front door to an army of reporters camped out on his front lawn. When you're under that kind of stress, under that kind of duress, that's not necessarily the best time to walk in front of the international media, but Ed Smart came out to address the media, and in hopes that his daughter Elizabeth might be able to hear him, he said to her, Elizabeth, wherever you are, we want you to know we're doing everything possible, and we are going to find you, and we're going to bring you home. He said that in hopes that she might hear it and somehow know, I'm going to be okay because my dad's on it. I think if you're a parent, like you're like, yeah, I totally get that. You don't even have to be a parent. You would do the same thing. Well, what happened was from then, for the next, about 9-10 months, she was held captive by this couple and unfortunately abused in every conceivable way repeatedly. And this really interesting thing began to happen. She actually began to lose her sense of self-identity. It's what's known as Stockholm Syndrome. So because of the trauma, because of the abuse that was just ongoing day after day after day, she actually began to identify with the people who had taken her, their prisoner. And so what happened was she slowly but surely began to drift away from Elizabeth Smart to the point where she actually thought, this is my real life. This story, this identity that these people are creating for me, she actually got to the point where she believed, this is who I am. Elizabeth Smart had completely drifted away from her life. And in March of the next year, a police officer, only about 18 miles from her parents' home, spotted a young lady on the corner and stopped and talked to her. and in the course of their conversation, completely unprovoked, the girl blurted out this sentence. I know you think I'm Elizabeth Smart, but I'm not. And the police officer asked her about her wig. She insisted that it was her real hair. He asked her about the people she was with, and she even insisted that those were her real parents. This is how far gone she was. And he pulled out a missing person's picture, and he held it up, and he got right in front of her, and he said this to her. He said, Elizabeth, I know who you are. You're Elizabeth Smart. And he told her, if you want to go home, you can. And it was in that moment that she had an awakening to who she really was. And I want to ask you to just take a daring step in this moment, no matter where you're at in your life, and consider the possibility that God might want to say to you, I know who you really are. And if you want to come home, you can. You can come home. And that's what the story of the prodigal son is really about. At the end of the story, the son's there with the pigs. He's at the lowest point he could possibly imagine being. And he says to himself, I'm going to go home to my dad, and I'm going to apologize, and I'm going to say, I'm not even worthy to be your son anymore. Just let me work for you so I can have some food. And he goes home, and this is what the story says. It says, while he was still a long way off, not after he got home and made it right, but while he was still a long way off, the father ran to him, and he kissed him. He hugged him. He put a ring on his finger, and he put a robe around him. If you're wondering how God will respond to you if you decide to come home, that's how God will respond to you. God is ready and waiting for you. And in the quietness of your own heart and your own mind, just right now, right here where we are, I want to ask you to pray this prayer. God, if you're real, would you make yourself real to me? God, if you're real, would you make yourself real to me? And I want to ask you to pray that every day for as long as you need to until you have resolution one way or another. God, if you're real, would you make yourself real to me? Pastor Rick's going to come up and he's going to close our time down. He's going to give you a few quick courses of action. If you're visiting today, be sure and stop by the Red Tent. They have some stuff for you. The importance of it is, if you're praying that prayer, God, if you're real to me, the things that they will give you will help you continue to pursue that, flesh that out. We want to make sure you have some tools. I don't want to ask you to make an emotional response to me and what I'm saying. I want you to have some tools to take the next steps. For everyone here in this room, we have enough of those little booklets, Can I Find My Way Back to God? Make sure you get one of those on your way out the door. A third course of action that you could take is just show up next week, continue the conversation, make room for God to work in your heart. Pastor Rick.